This episode, I'm joined by Brian Cotnoir to discuss his work on alchemy. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast and keep everything running, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Brian Cotnoir, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to be discussing broadly alchemy, though primarily in a way from two of your books. First one is Practical Alchemy, A Guide to the Great Work, which was published 2021. And then On Alchemy, Essential Practices and Making Art as Alchemy, which is 2023. And I guess you could probably tie this in to your own history, but I'm right in thinking that when I was reading On Alchemy, your latest book, you sort of mentioned in there that, I mean, this is like a very short book that you explicitly state you want to make alchemy as just as clear as possible what it is. But you also state in there that that might be your last, book on the last
There's a spoiler, but you have to get to the end. Mm-hmm. But the fact that that's actually caused a few folks to call in and ask me, "Are you okay?
Are you okay?
Oh yeah, I'm totally fine." What I meant by that, and still what I mean by that, is this is going to sound a little odd, but it's probably the last book I'll write in my own words. Mm-hmm. It's I don't have a lot of words. When I want to say something, I try to say it as, because I you know, like novelists and things, they'll talk about somebody walking through the doorway, you know, and it'll be a page of description. I can't do that. Mm. Right. So for me, it was, it probably will be the last thing I will write myself. Okay. It doesn't mean I will not be using words from putting things together and analyzing and whatever. But yeah.
Okay.
They also try to shut me up. Right.
Okay. I see. So, you are an alchemist. So, when did this all begin?
I would say in earnest, like seriously, like it was at a very young age. I was exposed to it. Not it meaning the actual practices and things, but a book on it. Very, very early on, I had gotten my adult library card when I was about 11 or 12, which meant I could, so I would roam the stacks and then I would just kind of read. And I came across this book on alchemy, and it's actually a very good one. I think it's by Reed. And it gives a very, very good, clear description, but it was, I couldn't determine if it was science or art. Mm-hmm. And it really annoyed me, right? As a kid, I was very interested in the sciences, and I also was pretty good at art. And the rest of my family is it was in the household. I didn't have a place to put it, right? It wasn't this and it wasn't that. And I kept going back to it because it annoyed me. Mm. And then it got so annoying, right? I began to read more and more of it. And then it's like any mystery. Right. As you start to dive into it, things are given a little more that kind of shows you're on a right track. And then you think, maybe if I go back and reread these things, I'll understand. And then you do. And then you go a little further. And then this is what I mean. It becomes a fascinating and interesting thing in and of itself. Mm. But what it brings you into is a really deeper understanding of sort of the human quest for wisdom, knowledge, or what have you. And you start to see commonalities in our, I mean, it's the same apparatus for so long, right? Approaching the material world, there are things that come up. And that's my interest. It's as replicating these experiments and doing these things, and then reading the philosophies, the worldviews, the theology, the debates that are going on, even though we may have moved in each of those areas in their own separate ways forward, right? Mm-hmm. There's always still a handful of little things that were left behind that when you look at, you go, you know, that's not bad. in terms of an idea, concept, or something like that. and so that's where I find in doing this work, it's not that I do like to do this. I just can't really anymore because I don't really have the studio and lab space to do it. But are the sophisticated experimentation, analyses, recreations, and pursuits, right, in the laboratory. But at the same time, I've gone, I feel deeply enough in these areas and in the outside philosophies and things that I start to see connections. And this is what I've tried to do in the latest book, was then to kind of distill that down into this, what the essential physical practices are, right? So you can understand those when you read an alchemical book and understand perhaps they're more, oh, I don't know, spiritual inner meanings that you could derive from them. At the same time, it's like these, just these very basic practices. And then what I do is, since alchemy is about creation, then with the Emerald Tablet states that basically creation is the same on any level, right? So anyone making anything inherently is kind of following the rules of the universe as it itself creates. And so if you're interested in alchemy but don't have a laboratory, there are still the processes, there are still the approaches, there are still the inner practices that you could use in any creative form, any action form, right? Poetry, painting, music, what have you. It's all working with elements. Right. And what are you doing? You're going down to the substrata of those, bringing them back up in different forms. That's art.
Absolutely. So I'm intrigued there because you first started getting into alchemy very, very young through these books. And
yes.
Then you couldn't figure out if it was science or an art. But alchemy is, you know, as you've already mentioned there, there's questions of theology and a lot of other things. So you often see alchemy within mystical esoteric circles. So did you have an interest in these adjacent fields as well? Were there questions that you were seeking out to be answered at that age?
Absolutely. See, because the whole thing at heart of my wandering the stacks in the library, I was open to everything and anything. So, I mean, it wasn't just the alchemy book I kept going back to. There were other ones. I mean, just odd books. Like you never, like as a, like, wow, they wrote a book on this. So of course I had to take it out. You know what I mean? It might've been on, like, you know, I don't know, whatever. The one thing that really caught my eye and really was the, cause at the same time as I'm going through the library, it's also a question of, okay, basically what's going on here, right? Meaning the world, right? It doesn't seem to be all what it is, and yet there seems to be more, if you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
And so that was at the heart of sort of my art probes, so to speak, and my interest in science, right? Because I saw the world as a very fluid place, perhaps too fluid, and I was using these two things to kind of anchor an understanding. I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time, but I look back at myself and go, yeah, it's probably what was going on, right? You know, I think as kids, we can have a more fluid perception of how the world is, what's permanent, what's not permanent, things like this. And I think if you're really observing things, like just as nerds do, watching ice frost on the window over an hour period of time, you know, there's a mind process there. And then there's the questioning, what's causing this formation, right? What is causing this crystallization of ice on the window in this most beautiful form, right? I mean, so I'm interested in this and I'm interested in that. And then I found the books on alchemy. And since I was somebody that was always trying things, I tried them, right? Yeah. I started, you know, had my own chemistry set, started trying to replicate these things. I mean, the first bona fide alchemy book I got it around 17. And it's the the Hermetic and alchemical writings of Paracelsus. It was like reading concrete, as I said. It was like, wow, okay, this is the real deal. And that's what I felt. It's just like, I'll just take my time until I understand. I worked out, I stayed out, when I graduated high school, I stayed out for a few years to work at an occult bookstore here in the city, so I would have time to read. And then when I understood, when I went and did my chemistry degree. So this is, but all at the same time, it's not just I'm interested in the material, because I wasn't. That was the structure I was seeing that was talking about a much deeper philosophies, much deeper understandings of the universe, of the cosmos, what have you. But I felt I needed those tools to be able to do that. Right. So that's why I went to the university or college. As I said to some of my friends who are professors, it's like, yeah, I didn't go to college to get a job. Do you know what I mean? I went there because there were tools I needed to do the work I needed to do. And if it was.
Did you tell the people at during your chemistry degree that you were an alchemist?
Well, I wasn't. I mean, no. I didn't really think of myself as that. I mean, I kind of call myself that because it's a fun thing to say. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's what I spend all my time researching, thinking about and doing, and then actually replicating experiments and then kind of creating art from those materials as well. Right. So, I mean, I don't know. It's like you're an artist because you make art. You're a plumber because you work with, I guess I could call myself a plumber. You know, I am working with lead sometimes. So, but that's the thing. It's, at the same time, you know, I started, you know, kind of practicing meditation and yoga when I was around 15 and been continuing until now. So all those aspects of it too, you know, meditate. And as you read in the book, I think that comes through that what I try to do in the new book, though, is to show how deeply rooted that is in the Western tradition, though. By showing where this shows up in the Hermetic writings, where this shows up in the Neoplatonic writings, this type of thing.
Yeah. So this question now is, and this is, you know, you do definitely show this within your books. This basic question now is far more broad than people would imagine, which is simply, what is alchemy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is what I've arrived at, but it's kind of ripping off some of the older alchemists. Right, Paracelsus, things like this, but I've kind of taken those and opened them up a bit more. So anybody who's ever heard a talk of mine, I always start out with a definition, so we're all on the same page. So forgive me if you've heard this, but I have no other way to say it. I say it's the art and science of bringing something to its final perfection / completion, right? And then I go ahead and unpack that, right? So art and science. It is really just that. It works with the, I'm about to laugh, methods of science. I just finished reading, for those science nerds out there, Philosophy of Science, Paul Feyerabend's Against Method. If you haven't read that, read it. I think anyone who is really interested in alchemy and other ways of knowing, and at the same time want to work with a scientific method, you must read this book. It is a very, and he's funny. That aside, so where was I going with that?
It was the definition of alchemy, but this seems.
That's it. Yes, yes, yes. So it's an art and a science. And so this is what I was saying about the science. You want the science part. You want the part where you go, okay, yeah, show me. And then it is what it is, right? In the 17th century, as alchemy was developed, and it was about to, you know, some of the societies around were about to develop into the Royal Society, there was a saying, per ignium, right? By fire, right? You're gonna put it out, you better put it up, and we're gonna test it, right? And this is what it's about. You want that. You want that in an alchemical practice. You don't need to be deluding yourself. It's easy enough. But at the same time, it's not the only way of knowing. Right. And this is what the book I mentioned Against Method is kind of about. It goes, you look back at scientific method and you look out throughout the history, you realize there is no method. Right. There are specific things that experimenters may do, but an overall that you could say, here is the method and I will teach it to you, doesn't exist.
No such thing as scientific method?
No, he that you could outline, define, and then apply to all the scientific discoveries.
Okay. Yeah, no.
That's what he's saying. And it's really funny because as he pulls it out, he goes, look at Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, he is so irrational. He is not fine. He is not using scientific evidence. He is using persuasive arguments and patronage. He is, you know what I mean? It is, and he just lays it out. It's like, it's really rather funny. But the point is, right, in order to make these moves in science, you got to make the moves in other ways of knowing. And that's what is being acknowledged here. And this is where you'll find within, oh, in the 70s, it was called a reenchantment of nature. In other words, that science was just totally, at this point, lost touch with anything that's going on, right? And it was, how do you bring that back into science? And this is still a big question now. And my general answer to is it, you don't. Right. It's not the tool, it's the user of the tool. Right. If you think the hammer is the only tool that there is and no other tool will do, well, you got problems. Right. But if you say it's one tool of 50, right, and this is the one I need for the nail, but the one I need for this thing is, you know, olive oil, it opens things up. Right. You still want to use that testing, showing, what have you, but this is what it's about. So that's the art and the science part of it, right? Mm-hmm. You want to use all ways of knowing. Contemporary use of this is modern medicine, right? Clinical practice versus, what do you call it? The scientific studies that are done.
Peer reviews.
Yeah. Evidence-based practice versus like clinical. This has been my 50 years of experience, 30 years of experience, even though all the data is saying this is how you treat this person, not this person.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So this kind of a thing, it's where you and when you have the balance of both, you've got a good doctor, you know what I mean? And then the something, right. I mean, you can feel what that is already. It's either the metals classically led into gold or the soul, right. The soul's reaching to the unity of the divine, what have you, and the stages and the processes that it moves through to go do that. So that's that something. And classically within alchemy, the metals were perceived to be on a spectrum, that they were really all one thing made up of the four elements, cooked in the earth in different ways under the influence of various planets. And what would result would be lead. And the one most balanced, perfect, influenced by that divine solar influence is gold.
Mm.
And what the alchemist would do would be to step in, and this is what Paracelsus says, to complete what nature has started, right? And that's where I get this idea of, well, that could be anything then, not just, right? So that's the something,
right? What would you say to refine, to make something, to transform something to become its perfect end?
Yes.
What does that look like for you?
Well, this is what I'm getting to.
Okay,
so now
sorry,
you have that something, right? That's the next part of the phrase, to its final completion, to its final, to its perfection, right? Now, this is a word, perfection, that is really fun to poke around and play with, right? Because one of the things that always happens, and it happens in the sciences, when a discovery is made or an insight, especially a deep insight into, say, the quantum level of physics, we are very tempted to bring it to the human level and explain our societal relationships with those ideas. And they may or may not hold up. It's like Darwin, right? Poorly used on a social level, right? Even though it explains motions on a genetic, biological level. So this is what I'm saying. So when you say the word perfection, right? It's like, okay, well, who's judging that, right? Who's to say what's perfect? Well, gold has its own solid, there are check marks there, right? So you could say, well, lead doesn't have those check marks, so it's imperfect. It's lead is imperfect gold, right? But lead is perfect in itself. Lead, nothing does lead better than lead. Nobody does copper better than copper. They're all perfect, complete in themselves.
Yeah.
It's when you're wanting to move them from one point to another, right, that you go, okay, I'm going to complete it because it doesn't have this, it needs that, it needs that. And once it has those things, we'll have transmuted it into this, right? And so that's the sense of it, right? There's a philosopher, Giordano Bruno, who writes and says, what does he say? It's the soul moving from perfection through perfection to unity, right? And that's essentially what it is. It's recognizing that, you know, lead isn't bad. Copper is not bad. Gold ain't so hot. You know, gold's a really lousy copper. You know, terrible iron. You know, so I mean, if you really are needing iron and you got a bunch of gold, you're screwed unless you're going to use it to buy it. But then you need to transform gold into iron, right? Because iron would be perfect for what you need. And then you get down into, well, anyway, a whole other ideas of use and function. And
so it seems like that process though goes on forever. There kind of would be a complete end. Otherwise, we'd be left with, you know, seems lovely that everyone would be perfected or that everything is gold. But as
yeah,
you
then
say,
you just go to the
we
beach.
We need copper. We need lead.
What I'm saying is that once you reach that level, you'll just go to the beach. You know, just chill. but you're right. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know. I don't really have an answer to that. But yes, it seems to be. As an artist, yes, I would have to say that, because as soon as I feel I may have moved through some types of work, right? I may say I've finished with that stage, right? Oh, that was that artist's particular thing, and then they move on to the next. It's like, yeah, so that may be perfect, but do I feel I've finished it? No. But so you're right, there's no end to it. I think as long as you're alive and are trying to make change, there's no end to it. You know what I mean? Because, I don't know, the curtains could always, you know what I mean? You can always tweak a little something. And I think that's the curse of the artist. And that's also the thing about perfection and completion. You got to know when to stop.
Things usually get far more ruined when you don't know when to stop. And then you can't retrieve them.
You can't. You cannot. I mean, it's like... Yeah, you just want to put that, if you just make that one more, you're gone, you know?
It's a very abstract question, but what do you think it is that is speaking to us in that moment where, you know, stop, even though we want to be very human and keep piling things on? There's something that, you know, I don't know what it is, but there's something that speaks and is saying to you, it's done, you need to move on. You know, you've finished that level, you need to move on to something more. What do you think that is?
I think you really need to be sensitive to that at first, because the will to perfect, the will to self-criticize that you are not and anything you do is shit. Do you know what I'm saying? Because you're going to want to do that. You know, if I just did this one more thing, it would be so good. If I did this one more thing, boy, mom would be pleased. It starts getting into, you know, you talk to people who have like these perfectionist things. You know, I worked in film. I used to do editing. And there comes a point where you reach the end of your budget. Do you know what I mean? And it is good. It's not perfect. But it's for television. And it's very good. But then you will have somebody who's always had a dream of becoming a director. Of somebody who's... family members were always pushing them to perfection, right? And this is towards the last week, and you can't go over, these people can be hell. Do you know what I mean? Because they don't recognize that what they're asking for, you don't need to do number one, because it is completed. And what you're doing is, well, you know, spoiling the atmosphere, ruining what have you, that comes about. But it is that thing. So I think it takes a great deal of courage, actually, to go to listen to that.
Seems then that alchemy, the process of alchemy, always needs limitations. It always needs borders.
I think it will meet them. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, no, I think as you go on, you start to meet limitations. You start to meet either your own limit. It doesn't need it. You'll provide them. Do you know what I'm saying?
Are they for our own safety?
I don't know. I mean, because you can plow ahead and ignore things. I mean, on the most basic fundamental level, explosions happen, right? Glassware breaks, acid is spilt, do you know? So, I mean, it's like these kinds of things. And even on a, you know, a probing question, you know, philosophically, theologically, whateverically, it's, you will. I mean, what I find very interesting about it is that you do come up against your own limits. And then how do you open those up? Mm. Or how do you just recognize, no, that's it. That's my limit, right? Like, I can't fly. I'd love to fly. Trust me, I've tried. That was one of the things my parents were very worried about, because I would throw myself off of garage roofs with cardboard wings. You know, as I said, I would try things. So they had to be very careful what came in front of my face, because I would, if it said, if you did this and this and this and put that together, you get that, be sure I am going to do it. Mm. And so this is the thing, you come across like your actual limits, right? I mean, time, even money, material resources, you know, will I able to, no, I can't do that. I mean, I could, but it would mean subverting or reverting everything else to that one thing. And is that what you really, then it becomes a triage, right? And you're always making, so you have your limitations. Mm. What I feel is, what do you learn from them, right? Are they really that, I mean, because you can get obsessed with it too. Mm-hmm. I'm going to show, you know, whatever, I am going to fly off the garage roof. You know, and that just becomes kind of self-defeating. So it is, I don't know. I think I had this rather blessed experience mm. at around 14, visiting my grandparents in Florida and befriending some neighboring kids who used to surf. Mm. And they said, go on, try it, you know, and fell off once or twice, but then I got on it and I rode it in. And it wasn't like, you know, big waves. I was like 12, 13. It's like, you know, waves, but I'm on the board. I have really good balance and I'm riding this thing in. And I did it a few more times. Mm. And then I used to think about this. I used to watch like streams in water, watching the pattern that never changed, but the water always changing, right? Mm. And I'd be like, wow, isn't that like life? And then I went and thought, like, the surfboard is like, well, is what it is. I have no control over the forces. But I control me. I can control the direction. I can add to the vector this way, that way, what have you. But what you need to do is be quiet. You need to listen. And you need to listen with all senses, your feet, your ears, your nose, whatever. No, it was like, I went out maybe four times, but this has stayed with me. It was like, wow, that's it, right? And then you hear some like surfer dudes talk, like kind of metaphysical. And it's like, no, you're right. I worked on a surf movie once and it was like, hey, no, they know what they're talking about. There's wisdom on the board.
Do you think that, you know, I have the question here to ask you really where alchemy begins in history, mm-hmm. And I guess what it originates from. But I guess there's a tangential question from that, which is, has the understanding really changed all that much throughout time? You know, is Paracelsus all that different to those surfers?
In form, I would say, not necessarily in desire or intent. I mean, I'm sure Paracelsus is a very funny character, so there's a lot coming up in my mind, and a surf dude is coming up as well. So those are two rather funny images at the same time. But at the heart of it, yeah, I do feel, if that's what they're going after. Mm. I would say, to get back to the original question and to kind of tease that forward, mm. It really is a mix of several things going back a few thousand years. I don't believe that there was ever like alchemy where the ancient Egyptians were believing in transmutation, mm-hmm. right? They were really good metallurgists and they knew some really good things, right? And it's those manuals. It is, what is it, the Leiden papyrus and the Stockholm papyrus are actually one papyrus. And they were, you know, as explorers do, well, I was with you and I found it. It goes to my museum. No, it goes to my museum. I'll tell you what, we'll split it. And that's what happened. So, but what this is a manual that was, sounds like a Hollywood movie, but found in a mummy's case who was a physician, mm-hmm. right? So he was buried with the recipe book for medicines, magic spells, and metallurgical, basically a recipe book. And this is parallels very closely the work that is had by Democritus, not the Democritus, the philosopher, but another one around 300 BC. They're almost identical. So what you see here is the practice of it. You see the basis for the material of it. But then there's, and also within the Greek, the Egyptian religion, the afterlife, the progress of the soul, et cetera, is there. But you don't really see it explicit within the metalwork, right? You start seeing it with the advent of some of the Neoplatonic Hermetic philosophies that come about. And then it's this fusion where if you read Zosimos, it feels as if it's almost like this is a practice. We're making glass, we're making this, and here's the processes. But what they also have are inner meanings and inner effects, let's say. It's like icon painting is the way I refer to it in the in my book, right? The process of iconography, reflecting stages in the soul. And as the painting evolves, it reflects your spiritual evolution, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So it's these ideas. And then they get really developed. But the material idea then becomes somewhere along the line. And very early on, that you can change one thing into another. Mm-hmm. It's like, why wouldn't you think that? Look at the world. Everything changes. I mean, and you can just start going ahead and aiming. Look at ice turns to steam, turns to water. Look at caterpillars. Nature loves change. That's what it does, you know? And so you start working and then you see it. It does. You develop theories around it, you know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then off it goes, right? Into Islam, into the West, and then it just keeps going. You know?
It always has a connection with something that we might consider God, the divine, the sacred, that's always there.
True, true, true. In one way or another, right? Because there are Buddhist alchemies.
Right.
And there's not a belief of a creator God. Mm. They're deities and things, but there's no big honcho. There might be for a little while in some place or another, but you know, there's a beginning and an end. So there doesn't. But what I would say there is a recognition of a unity of being, right? Now, whether that unity of being has volition, omnipotence, etc., you know what I mean? Don't ask me. I'm just figuring out what I'm doing here. Mm-hmm. You know? I lean more towards I go with the unity of being. I find that I find it a richer way of working, or of understanding. I find it provides a more of a network rather than a line, if that makes any sense.
So do you think one could be, you know, sort of a very stereotypical modern outlook of atheist materialist? Could you be an atheist materialist alchemist?
Oh, yeah, as long as you're open to other ways of knowing and recognize there's a unity of being, I would say absolutely yes. And I would say the other side would be a certain ethics and morality where you're not just there for yourself, but you do recognize the unity of being, meaning that the, you know, human and then the other animals too, kind of a thing, that you're not just me, 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 I am the most brilliant and the greatest, watch what I can do. No, right? But not believing in a creator God, sure, why not? I mean, you don't have to. What helps, though, if you're doing actual research in the time period and a particular alchemist or alchemists, what have you, you really do need to know. You should read the philosophies, you should read the holy books, you should read some of the theological debates around it, as well as the mainstream, but also pick up on a couple of the heresies.
Well, you mentioned Giordano Bruno earlier, so you know,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, come on.
It's the ultimate heretic, yeah.
Yeah.
So is that a way in which, you know, we sort of have this strange abstract process of alchemy, which is, you know, the signifier is doing a lot of work to hold some bigger thing throughout history mm-hmm. together. But amidst that is all these singular alchemies, which draw from their contextual gods, contextual symbols.
Yeah. See, I think it's more like there's this human desire to know and control and to have an understanding and make things more and better. Mm. Right. I just think that's just something in the DNA. Because I think no matter what, any primate does this. I think any mammal does this. You know, you want to be warm, dry, and have food, you know, this kind of a thing. And then just more. Right. So I think that it's more like this type of drive in different areas, different cultures, different times comes up with these things. And then what I think ends up happening, we can step back and see an overarching kind of thing that has a commonality to it and then call that alchemy. Right. Kind of like looking at all the stuff and then coming up with a theory or something. But I don't think there was ever this, it becomes so, with us looking back, it becomes so more in, say the 14th century when it enters Europe, right? Becomes a defined area. And it is like in India, in Ayurvedic medicine, it's a branch of Ayurvedic medicine called Rasa Shastra, right? The medicine of the juice, the medicine of mercury. This is actually, you can go do a degree in the medical universities there in Rasa. I actually have one of the textbooks here. And they have some of the transmutational things in there, right? So it's there. You know, and has been, and each different culture approaches it a little differently. And even now, I mean, it's where I find it really lively. Is both in herbal medicines and medicines, that sort of an obvious thing, but is in agriculture, farming, biodynamic gardening, Rudolf Steiner type things, who have taken these ideas. And then really, it's like, it's how I feel like with art, right? Okay, fine. You know, changing lead into gold, let's be honest, is really cool, mm-hmm. right? But it's mm-hmm. like a one-trick pony,
right? Have you done that?
Yeah, I have. No, folks, no. Don't get all excited and break it into my apartment, torturing me for the answers. No. It is an old, one of the methods I kind of put together out of the Greco-Roman things is what is known as depletion gilding, mm-hmm. right? And if you read what depletion gilding is and you go back through, like you read Pliny, he talks about Corinthian gold, right? And it's this thing that looks exactly like gold, but it's about a third the weight. Mm-hmm. And what he's talking about is, well, Corinthian gold. It's a gilding process where you take copper. Do you want to hear something really interesting? This is like work with myth. Okay. Absolutely. This will also tie in with another idea here, how like alchemy in 16th, 17th centuries, and even now, works with myth, not as we do. Mm. They see it as actual descriptions of alchemical processes, mm-hmm. like living chemical processes. So the myth of the birth of Apollo and Diana, right, the two goddesses, god and goddesses, the golden twins, children of Leto, right? And Zeus impregnated her, as he, I think, does everybody. Juno was not very happy with this and was chasing Leto all across the Mediterranean, hit out on Delos, and gave birth. Firstborn was Diana, who turned around and acted as a midwife for the birth of Apollo, mm-hmm. okay? So in alchemical ideas, Leto represents copper. Mm-hmm. Zeus would be tin. Apollo obviously is gold, and Diana is silver. So here is the gilding process, right? Depletion gilding process. You would take copper. You would sometimes add either lead or tin, right, mm-hmm. as a something that would eat out easily. Mm-hmm. And then you would add silver, right? You could also add gold, but that's to make gold. You first add silver, right? You fuse it all together, working with certain salts. You impact it in there. It leaches out the tin, the lead, the copper, and just leaves the silver on the surface, right? And then you kind of burnish it. It is silver, 100% silver. Okay. So now if you want to make gold, you remelt that. You put in a little bit of gold. You go through the whole process, leach it out. It takes out the silver or whatever, leaving the gold on the surface. So first, if you tried to do it with just gold alone and copper, it doesn't work. Okay. So you have to have first the silver, then the gold coming out of copper, right? This parallels the myth to the alchemist's eye very clearly, right? And so I don't know where we were going with this, but alchemical examples of things.
Mm. Well, I guess, you know, throughout history, how things are contextual and different as per.
Exactly.
We do. I'm going to assume we don't sort of have a more, you know, modern equivalent of such myths of how we describe alchemical processes now, I guess, since the advent of what was initially called the natural sciences, which became the sciences, it's right. become more so a very sort of material focused pursuit that doesn't have these tie-ins with myth, or would I be wrong there?
You mean the sciences, or you mean alchemy now?
Alchemy now.
Oh, alchemy now. No, people will play with it. People work with it because it is the tradition.
Mm.
Even folks who are mostly focused on, if you talk to them, that's what they'll talk about, but they have their own inner spiritual practice.
Okay.
Right? They may not write about it because this is what I always say. It's not like say the most materialist of alchemists, like Sir Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't atheists. They were absolutely devout, whatever flavor Christian they were. You know, and Newton was a little heretic there too. You know, he was not into the Trinity thing.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, no, monad, come on. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? So this is the thing I say. It's that there's a spiritual aspect to alchemy throughout alchemy. It's in the alchemists, right? Yes. In Islam, in Islamic alchemy, Arabic alchemy, they don't have the limitations as to what you can know. Oh, you should not know that. No, to know it is to get closer to God, get closer to the Creator. And how that's not an unholy thing to do, right? And so that's the thing. It's like the spiritual aspect was always there. What you didn't find is a great explication within the writings, within the images, calling that out.
Mm.
You do find it within the mystics who will use alchemical language. And there's always exceptions. I mean, it's not, I'm speaking most generally here because I'm talking about alchemy. You will always find some really good, clear exceptions, right? Especially within the Islamic alchemists.
So I guess to sort of clarify definitions, how does it differ from chemistry?
I would say it differs from chemistry in that it uses all ways of knowing.
Okay. So it's a holistic science.
Yeah, I would say it's a far more holistic approach to something.
Mm.
Right. I mean, I studied chemistry. I have a degree in chemistry. I worked in a laboratory as a chemical analyst for about 3 months before going on to film school. No, it's great. I mean, it is potent. It is potent material to work with. I'm not talking chemicals. I'm talking the analytical thought process of understanding these procedures and then how you can intervene with them to create something. I used to call it microsculpting, right? You're creating molecules and they have shapes. You know, what is it? The Buckminster Fuller, the Buxterine, right? I mean, that's a little micro sculpture. So it's more about it's about ways of knowing. And science is, rightfully, wrongfully, has limited itself to this. It'd be like, so is poetry, right? I mean, poetry isn't being expected to be held up to, certain physical principles. It's like, why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's missing it. Well, yeah.
So
it's supposed to.
Absolutely, absolutely. As per your definitions, I mean, all these sort of multitude of definitions now. So we've got unification of being, which is your own, and I guess medieval unity or medieval perfection was the unification with the soul with God.
Right.
And then in general, just this refining to become the perfect, well, refining towards perfection. Who would you say has been the most successful alchemist, if we're to take them at their word?
Wow. I don't know.
No?
No, I mean, I'm really seriously thinking about it. Like, I never really thought of it because then, well, first of all, to say they were successful in terms of transmuting lead into gold, you got to show me, right?
Well, you've done it. So, I mean, you're successful.
Well, okay, yes. Well, then, yes. In that case, yes. Oh, if you're talking about who are people that are replicating these things and coming to great success and matching what's being described, not necessarily what's claimed to function. Mm. Oh, there's a lot of folks out there. I mean, there are some folks at universities doing this.
Yeah. But I guess when you say, look at the spiritual angle, has there been any sort of great alchemical feats of...
I don't know, Nelson Mandela?
How do you mean?
Well, I don't know. Look what he did.
And you no, I'm intrigued there. You understand that as an alchemical process?
There's a major change, right? There is somebody, not by themselves, obviously. This isn't a one-person gig. No, I mean, this is the other thing too. It's if you look at alchemical philosophies, if you look at any philosophies, particularly the ancient Greek philosophies, it's all about community. It's about Pythagoras, whether this is a fact or not, doesn't really matter because in the second century, it was considered a fact. Mm. Pythagoras, when he was in greater Greece, with lower Italy, where my family's from, he organized his followers, taught his followers to go town to town to organize there to overthrow tyrants. Mm. Okay. The idea being that this was not a wise way of living. This is not a good for the people kind of a thing, right? So within philosophy, within this is always this idea of, and rather utopian, it comes really surging to the forward in like in the 17th century, this idea we can perfect anything, right? Kind of ties into all sorts of Calvinist and theological sort of perfection and, you know, look at my wealth, you know, God loves me. So it has all these things, right? So yeah, I think anybody who is really looking to make a change, because that's what alchemy is, it's change. It's about understanding the structure of something, understanding the flow of that, and knowing how to get it from here to there, right? So I think folks who have a social insight, political insight, good, bad, or indifferent, hopefully, because to me, alchemy is a very positive direction, going to gold, whatever that metaphor may be, this kind of a thing. So, yeah, and that's why I always emphasize in any kind of hands-on workshop, I ask, what are you doing this for?
So that's actually what I was about to ask. I mean, I guess to draw on alchemical language and your alchemical experience, what is it that stops people from changing?
Oh, well, that's...
Sorry, that's a big question.
No, it is. It's both an inner and outer thing. It's an outer crust and an inner crust that got habituated to the outer crust and gotten comfortable. And then even though all of a sudden you may be aware of the limitations you have taken on in yourself, those outer limitations are there that still hold you back. Which is why sometimes working in concert with others, you might be able to kind of soften those boundaries and open them up, right? I mean, within some spiritual traditions, they speak of dogma as a very positive thing. At the same time, in the same breath as they speak about dogma as a positive thing, they speak about dogma as the way you get your training to overthrow dogma from within, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like I had studied iconography. And they were saying, well, of course, there's iconoclasm, which is bad. But don't forget, as you go on in your practice, there is a holy iconoclasm, meaning that the one that gets past the image, right? The one that's like, instead of like mistaking the image for what have you, you break through that one, right? So it's these ideas as
There's
well.
a point where you have to betray your principle.
Well, I think in some ways, I don't want to say that, but
Or
in
knowing when is correct too.
that's exactly it. There's actually this really remarkable, it's like I should pull it out to have it at ready at hand because I don't think this will be the first time this comes up. There's an alchemical writer philosopher from the 7th century, Stephanos of Alexandria, right? He was in Constantinople. He was sort of the court philosopher, mathematician. He actually was there when the writer from Mecca had come with messages that there's a new prophet and that the emperor should convert. So Stephanos of Alexandria casts the astrological chart for Islam. Yeah, pretty cool. What he also said, though, as he's talking about the ascent of the soul and alchemy and the practice of alchemy, is that he goes, first of all, what is the beauty of a chrysocolla compared to beauty, compared to beauty, right? This right there implies the ascent of the soul, the platonic, right, from the concrete to the abstract to the absolute. So you have the material chrysocolla. It's a stone used in gold work. So what is the value of that compared to the real thing? Then he goes on. He goes, but as you go on, basically it's like, well, if you see Jesus on the way, kill him. Don't let that hold you back. There's a vow of material poverty, and you will reach a point where you must sever that as well. And I saw that, I'm like, wow, but that's Neoplatonic philosophy. Plotinus, where he goes, how far, how far? Well, you know everything. How do you do this? Well, cut everything away, right? So
Everything
you cut away.
is fuel.
Everything is what?
Fuel. Fuel for
Yeah,
yours.
essentially, I mean, this is some deep meditative material, right? Sometimes I think in Buddhism referred to as a diamond drill, because you go here, then you go there, and you go here, and you go there, and it's just like woo, 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 woo. At some point you're just like, wow, how deep have I gone, right? It's, too bad you're not in New York. This is fun.
So let's I guess to draw in, because your books do have an emphasis on the practice of alchemy, and it is what many people would
That's true.
imagine, which is, stood in a lab with flasks and looking, if you want, wear a robe and look nerdy.
Yeah,
But
go for it.
to begin with that, the practical, we need to bring in the elements. So where do the
Yes.
elements come in? Where does this all begin?
Well, I mean, philosophically, it's with Aristotle, but that's like the four elements of fire, air, earth, water. And it starts with Aristotle's definition of the elements. And beneath those elements, he has two principles of hot, cold, warm, no, yeah, hot and cold, wet and dry. And the interactions of those, like hot and dry, will make fire. And these are the four elements. Now, when the alchemists and the philosophers speak of the elements, it's usually with a capital E, and they're more the principles of things. So fire, yes, actual fire does have the things they're talking about as a metaphor. So it has an intense energy. There's a thinness to it, an almost non-existence to it. There's something about it that can permeate anything. It gives off light, heat. Everything has that kind of a quality to one degree or another in it. So they use this idea of elements as to how the world was comprised. So earth is the thing that gives a solidity and a structure, right? Water, things that are fluid, malleable, even if you add it with a certain amount of earth, this kind of an idea. And air is what they call motile. It moves. It's just something that is very thin and it moves and it permeates as well, right? So underneath air is hot and wet. Underneath cold is cold and wet. And right here is the beginning of the idea of transmutation. Because if you take water cold and wet and just add heat, it turns it into air. You've changed one element, water, into the other element, air. And right there, you have the fundamental possibilities understood philosophically and witnessed in the world, as transmutation is definitely possible because it's happening.
And what and about so this elusive fifth element?
Oh, well, the elusive fifth element, right? Aristotle refers to as space, the place where something exists, the place for this to happen, right? Now that, as alchemy goes on, right, because it is the fifth element, also called, the other elements are also known as essences, right? So you have four essence, fire, air, earth. So this is the fifth essence or the quintessence. That starts to take on, because you also have different philosophies as to what fills up this space. And for this one philosophy known as Stoicism, it was this material, they call it the pneuma, right? Which means a breath. And for them, it was something really fine fire and really fine air, right? But not material in the early philosophy. It's almost like a more conceptual mathematical thing. But as it goes on, in alchemy particularly, it gets seized on as an actual material substance. And that everything has fire, air, earth, water, and the quintessence is accessible to us to a certain degree. And the penultimate quintessence that alchemists work with comes from grape. So traditionally you would chop up the wine, you chop up the grape, you bury it in barrels, you bury it under the earth, you wait until spring, you let it resurrect, and you take the spirit out, right? You distill the spirit, the quintessence, right? And that quintessence you distill over and over and over again until it is as pure as it can be. And then according to one of the earliest alchemists, what you do is you circulate that, what they call aqua ardens, that burning water, right? Because it's not a quintessence yet, actually. So you evaporate the alcohol, because that's what it is. You evaporate the alcohol, it condenses in a condenser, and it drips back in on itself. And so right there, you have an echo of the Emerald Tablet, right? The above comes from the below, and the below comes from the above. And it takes on the powers of the above, and it takes on the powers of the below, and it unifies it. So that's the quintessence when the early alchemists are speaking of. And this can withdraw, take out anything from herbs, as you know, even if you just use vodka to take out the, you know, and soak some rosemary in it for its medicinal qualities. But those are the four elements. And it's not that they thought that, you know, a table actually, well, it does actually have fire in it, because if you put one little spark and fire in it, it releases all the other fire. So they would go, it does. But it's not like these are material things all over. It's more the conceptual idea of fire, air, earth, water, and these ideas. But in practical alchemy, they take on a material manifestation.
So right? I guess to turn to practical alchemy, perhaps it would be a good idea. Give us an example of one of your personal favorite practical alchemical practices, and then we can perhaps draw in how what this looks like symbolically beneath or within.
Whoa, okay, those practical okay. Workings. Yeah. Well, here's. I mean, this to me is like the, and it's in the book. Mm-hmm. It was the simplest and the most profound moment, and it's really, really, really simple. Because what was going on, I was working on two problems at the same time that were related on one level, but I didn't realize how deeply until I... So here's what it was. I have another work called Alchemy, the Poetry of Matter. And in there, I have translations of the Emerald Tablet, both from the Arabic and from the Latin. Mm-hmm. As I was refining and working over the translation of the Latin, I mean, of the Arabic, they're both almost identical because the Latin is a translation of the Arabic. There's a line in there, right? The one we all know, as above, so below, as below, so above. Except it doesn't say that in the Arabic and it doesn't say that in the Latin. It says that the above comes from the below and the below comes from the above, right? Now that's very striking to me. So much so I had several emails back and forth, both with my Latin tutor and my Arabic tutor, saying, "Really? Is there another meaning I'm missing here?" And they go, "No, absolutely not." As a matter of fact, in the Arabic, there's several other shades that really emphasize what you're talking about, meaning that each thing originates each other. There's an arising that is, you can't have one without the other. So that I'm working on, and I'm just refining it, and I'm working on this. At the same time, I give hands-on workshops, or did pre-COVID. And one of the things that always comes up, living in New York City, people have very tiny apartments, places. What can I do in my kitchen? What kind of equipment do I really need? Expensive stuff. So I was always experimenting with different, really small-scale apparatus. So I came up with one based on a 13th century diagram, which is essentially a mason jar and a martini glass with the stem cut off, right? You fill the mason jar, you fill the, yeah, anyhow. And so this would be a circulation device. If you put this cut off stem martini glass inside the mason jar so it fits, and inside the mason jar is, like, say, the alcohol you distill to perfection, right? So it's 95% pure. And in the top you had ice in the cup section of the martini glass, and you put it on some heat, the alcohol will evaporate, it will condense when it contacts the martini glass, and it will drip down, right? So that's what I was ex this is a circulation device, really simple to make, easy to use. So as it's going on, I'm over at my desk, kind of working, looking at it, checking on iguana, and there's this it was really cool. Around this, no one can, around the surface of the martini glass, a little cloud had formed. And as I looked even closer, it looked like there were little rain droplets. And I'm thinking, first of all, Big Rock Candy Mountain, the song comes on in my head. And then I'm wondering, where is that coming from? Is there a leak in the system? Is some air getting in there? And I say to myself, where is that coming from? And then I say to myself, oh, I see, it's coming from below. Ha! What they're describing in the Emerald Tablet is a circulation device, which is exactly one of the devices used and described in all the alchemical works, called a kerotakis, which is based on a Greek painting instrument. So this is one of the things I'm talking about, where in doing one of these experiments. Another one was, I was doing some, and again, these are the ones that kind of go, there's something more kind of going on here, and triggered some other research more than, like, Eureka, you know, I got what they have, right? I was going to be doing some metalworking, and to get used to it, I was melting tin at home. Okay, right? Low melting point on the stovetop, and so I made plaster casts of things just because why not? I have molten metal, see what happens. So I always usually start any kind of project with either drawing, sculpting, making the Platonic five elements, right? Or an Ouroboros of some kind. So I figured, okay, I'll make a little Ouroboros, put it on something, stick it in the thing. And, you know, maybe someday at the center of the Ouroboros, I'll draw something, paint something, or do something, right? So I pour the metal, put it into the oven, you know, take the mold out, pour it into the, put it into the thing, let it cool down, break it open, and I almost peed my pants, right? Because the snake was now a golden yellow, and it had, where it was an empty space, an egg. It was this white curved thing around it. So I had it on this tin pedestal, this golden snake holding an egg. And I'm like, okay, this is, and then the idea of staining or tinting surface metal as part of the alchemical process, it reminded me of that. I was working more kind of towards alloys on things, but then it reminded me that, yeah, indeed, there was this surface treatment of stuff going. So it was probably some sulfur that adhered to the tin through a slow thing from the beeswax I had used that was melt that was still all this stuff. Everything was there chemically, if you wanted to understand it, right? But at the same time, in terms of when I was doing it, the symbolism involved, what I was starting, and all this other stuff, this is what I mean, where the material becomes a little bit, you know, there's a little bit, to me, there was a little bit more going on, right? Not coming from the material side, coming from my side.
Yeah.
Right? My understanding, my seeing, my whatever. Because that's it. It's not just the stuff. You know, it's you and the stuff. It's like your art. Right? I mean.
Mm-hmm. Once again, it's subject object is really all one.
Yeah, that's it. There's a moment. It's like when you wake up and you have a dream and you understand the dream, but yet like it goes away in a moment, but you understand?
And something has settled, has dissipated.
Something is there. Something has gone. And it was really at that point where I thought, okay, you know, all right, something's going on. Thank you. You know, bust my ass harder now.
did it get, after those moments, did things, was there further sort of, yeah, I mean, I guess it, was there a great.
Yeah, the work just kept going. I mean, I just felt like I was on a next level. And I don't mean that like, ooh, I'm seeing things, I'm feeling things. I just felt like I had completed something. And in that sense, it comes into that thing is perfect, even though it's not, right? There's nothing perfect about it. Anybody looking at it will critique the hell out of it. I showed it to any one of my artist jeweler friends. They would go, what are you calling this shit? It's a good waffle, right? Perfect, what? But that's exactly the point. You know, it is that momentary aha-ness of it, right? Where your work has kind of come to a point and you're at the point, I think. I don't know. I'm still exploring all this. I don't have an answer. And that's what I always say, you know, all knowledge is provisional.
I was going to add that in there, that story makes it seem like alchemy is constantly testing one in the fact that it's not permanent. It doesn't have a permanent.
Right. It's a discussion. See,
you get something and then it gets back into the aura. I mean, the Ouroboros is the perfect,
yeah, that's perfect it.
Symbol for that.
Because once you understand something, I mean, any artist gets this. Once you've kind of like worked something, then you take a look back at what you did to get to there. You go, should I redo that?
Well, it's a different person, isn't it?
But it is. That's it, though. So you go,
quite literally.
Yeah. And then somebody who's kind of smart will go, no, leave it. That's what it is. Look forward, start the next cycle. You know what I mean? Unless you got something marketable there, then yeah, you got to live. So maybe bring it up to a level and then sell it. Seriously, artists.
But there's nothing worse, though, in a way of having to market something that you since can't believe that you had anything to do with, right?
It feels strange. I have to say, I have not had that experience. I don't know if that's fortunate or unfortunate.
I mean, you've written quite a lot of books. Have any of your old books, do you go back and think, you know?
No, I don't.
No? Oh, okay.
No, I honestly don't. There are some films I go back and I look at and I do that with.
Yeah.
Just simply, I look at that and I go, I wish we had $5,000 more and at least 2 more weeks, right? Because you go right in there, if we just opened that up a little bit, did a little of some sound stuff, and that would really satisfy. No one's saying it's not good. No one else is seeing it but me as the one who made it. It's like, oh, if I only. So no, the books, the zines are just insane. So I never go back over those, and because they're just kind of in the moment, sort of, even though that in the moment may take you 2 years to complete. But the poetry of matter, I feel I would go forward. You know, I would take whatever was in there and then kind of, which I did with the alchemy on alchemy. I mean, it's the same insights I have in Poetry of Matter. Poetry of Matter is an alchemical book. So I drew from that thinking that, well, you kind of need to read this and as an artist want to draw out and apply it to your art. Whereas on alchemy, I kind of lay that out, exercises, ideas, drawings,
The books are getting more refined. I think from Practical Alchemy to On Alchemy, there's a...
Well, what I don't know. Have you seen Poetry of Matter?
I haven't, no. Sorry.
They have that. Watkins carries that. So you can, for ordering it from me to here, it's really expensive from US to UK. But there's a place called Igloo Tree. That carries my work. It's online in England. And then Watkins carries it as well. That one, I'm looking, I don't have it right at hand here, I could hold up. But that one, I think you'll see that actually on Alchemy's Calm Down.
I see. Okay.
Right? Poetry of Matter is more like, it's more like a very refined zine aesthetic in terms of there's like a central text and then there's usually a lot of impinging other. It's also something you could read from the back, not literally backwards, but chapter by chapter, you could read it backwards. You could go forward. Yeah, I love it. It's a lot of fun. So,
Where would you advise people to begin with alchemy?
I mean, if they're interested in the laboratory stuff, right? I would honestly say, in all honest modesty, I would say Practical Alchemy, the book I wrote. And then there's a book by Robert Bartlett called Real Alchemy. And he's still teaching now. He's teaching out in Washington State in the States, and he does online courses. He's been doing this since the 70s. I don't know if anyone is familiar with Frater Albertus and the Philosophical, the Paracelsus Research Society in Utah. He was their guy, right? He was their chemist. He was doing, and his work is impeccable. So I would look up Robert Bartlett, especially if you're looking to go into or researching and trying out some of the more mineral and metallic work. It's where he's really replicating some of the actual alchemical recipes. I'm going to plug his book. It's called Real Alchemy, and then there's another one he did, The Book of Antimony. And if anybody is interested in transmutational alchemy, you must have that book. That's all I'm going to say. But I would start with either mine, Practical Alchemy, and the reason is that I give a very good introduction in theory. It's not just a bunch of recipes in practice, although that is there. I talk about how to read an alchemical book, right? So, and it's full of, appendices of symbols and tools and charts and how to get started and first experiments and all this stuff. So I would say, and I had written for Frater Albertus's journal on parachemy. I was writing some of the lab techniques and things, so I know what I'm talking about. You can follow this and actually get started. And Robert's book is the same way. So that's where I would, in terms of an inner, it also depends what you mean by that. There's very, I would say there are a few books that touch on this as a whole. And therefore, I would say really on alchemy is where I would start. There are references in there to like primary sources that will, but they can go deep quickly. So what I try to do is to kind of give it to you what the practices are, give you the sources, kind of verifying that I'm not just making this up, and then encourage you to go deeper, right? And then I'm trying to think if there's another. I mean, there are things, if you know what it's talking about, you can see how it applies to alchemy, right? There's a work called Theurgy and the Soul by Dr. Gregory Shaw, which I would recommend, dealing with theurgy. And if you understand alchemy, you see it in there, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wrote on Alchemy Essential Practices. I give courses, and I'd be asked this question, what book could I, is there a book out there? And I would have to name either chapters or things that kind of. If folks are interested in a more Jungian interpretation of alchemy, I mean, I couldn't recommend anything because there's a plethora of material and a lot of it looks really good. If you're looking for someone who is maybe giving courses online, there's an artist here in New York who is a Jungian, like hung out with a. Her name is Anne McCoy, and teaches through Yale and the Jung Center and things like this. So her focus is strictly Jungian, though. But those are stuff. So that's kind of where I would go. If you want to know more about me, I would check out my website, keprepress.com. I have a mailing list. I don't do anything but give talks and make zines and books. So if you're interested in knowing that, check out keprypress.com. And that's the last time I'll plug.
Oh no, it's absolutely fine. I mean,
Yeah,
I'll be
no,
sure
I
to
know.
put the links for
I will. I
your books
definitely.
and your site in the description below. Is there anything
Totally.
you'd like to add about? Obviously, our discussion has been very broad, and there's always going to be
Yeah.
things that we miss, but is there anything key that you want to add in about
Not,
alchemy?
no, not, not, not really. I really do feel, I mean, this has been great, really. I feel like, I mean, aside from like, I don't want to say the usual questions, you really brought some very interesting things to the foreground. I really appreciate that because, you know, you do a lot of talks and it ranges from kind of who's prepared and who's not, or who knows or who has thought about it. And reading the, and then just, this has been great. Really, thank you. I can't thank you enough, you know, because it is, it's satisfying, you know, to, you know, you work on something for so long and then somebody gets it, you know.
No, I think your books are very accessible. I can't say I can't really say more than that. But yeah, it's been a really fun conversation. And perhaps if the chance arises, we'll talk again.
Yep. And if you find yourself in New York or coming to NYC, let me know. It'd be fun to hang out and do this face to face.
Absolutely. Brian Cotnoir, thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Really enjoyed this.